Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a very happy Wednesday, January 28th, 2026 to everybody. This is Chase, along with a core team of Nick and Jason, back at you with another podcast, which is exciting. A lot to cover today. We're going to start with basketball. We just watched kind of a heartbreaking loss, attempted comeback in Iowa City against the Hawkeyes. USC loses, I think, 72-71 or 73-72. USC was like a 9.5-point dog in this one. And jumped out to a big lead. Then that slowly crept away at the end of the half. And then second half, the other team goes and builds a big lead on us. And then kind of one of the most remarkable, I would say, from a story for USC basketball standpoint, what Cam Woods performed in this game today was, I think, something we'll probably never forget. I mean, just out of nowhere, just goes on this huge scoring spree in defiance of a lot of naysayers, I have to say, and a lot of criticism, including from me. So just what a performance there from him. But it leaves SC now 4-6, I think, in the Big Ten, and a lot of things to discuss. So we have Nick and Jason to talk about this, but I guess we'll take it maybe step by step here. What I've definitely noticed, guys, in our recent game, there seems to be a very distinct pattern, which is we'll get out these early leads. Then two or three of our key guys, Chad, Ezra, and Jacob, will get in two fouls. They go to the bench, and over the last anywhere from 7 to 4 minutes, we give up those leads. That certainly happened today, and it actually happened very late. I think we gave it up like in the last 2.5 minutes, Iowa went on this big run. And then we start the second half, and maybe it's a little back and forth. But, you know, we'll get out to a lead. We'll give it up. The big stat that before Cam Woods hit a couple threes down the stretch tonight, we had, in the last three games coming into tonight, shooters other than Chad Baker-Mazzara had been 3 for 35 for 3-point line in the previous three games. Today, until Cam Woods hit those shots, it was over 5. So we had basically been 3 for 40 over most of a 4-game stretch from all our shooters outside of Chad Baker-Mazzara. And that's, I mean, just the overall kind of inability to hit score from the outside from our guards has just been kind of a killer for this team. And of course, we haven't had Jordan Marsh the last two games. I actually got word from the SID that he was cleared today and he was supposed to play. And then I think he went out and practiced and or did the warmups and couldn't go. So, you know, Nick, I'll let you talk first, but, you know, I have to say there's a lot of resilience from this team. We look terrible at times, but then we come back and either make a game of it or, you know, sometimes, you know, pull it out. But by the same token, like, we are really struggling on in aspects of this team. And what I'm seeing is, you know, until Cam Woods just went nuts today, like, we just cannot get scoring from our guards unless you consider Chad Baker-Mazzara a guard. And that's caused all kinds of issues because, like, today he had – we basically had to pull him out of the game because he was turning the ball over so much. And then he came back in and he was being face guarded. We just didn't give him the ball as much, so he didn't turn it over, but he didn't score either. So anyway, Nick, I'll throw it to you first for just your thoughts on what you've been saying.
Yeah, Chase, heartbreaking game, obviously. Right there at the end. Then just the way it kind of slipped away in the last few seconds is tough. But just to highlight the Cam Woods performance, I think this was the most unexpected, at least offensive performance I've ever seen from a USC basketball player, given not only what he did and how he scored, but just given how poor he's been on offense in the prior games. Just came out of nowhere. And, you know, you have to give the kid a ton of credit. And he was great on D too. Like, he turns Sturts' water off in the second half. And I think that it wasn't as important as his offensive performance, but he was excellent on D too. So just give him all the credit in the world. To throw a few numbers, not only on this game, but just in conference play, we're 18th in the Big Ten in 3-point percentage. We're at 26.7 from three in league play, and we're 15th in effective field goal percentage, and we're 15th in turnover margin. So we can't shoot, and we throw the ball away. So it's a really bad combo, and we can't shoot free throws either. So it's been really tough, and I think the lack of a competent lead guard is a big part of the problem. And not having Rodney Rice hurts a lot. And as you can see, Chad, can get very turnover prone at times, and it really killed us in this Iowa game here. So, don't know if there's an answer, just given the personnel limitations with the injuries of this team. But hey, maybe Cam can go for 30 plus every night, and we can win some games here.
Yeah, Jason, I don't know if Cam going, I don't know what's realistic. I mean, obviously, he has a layoff, so he was never a great shooter to begin with, but he was somewhat of a competent scorer, and we kind of been missing that. And of course, he's moving up a level, so you never know what he's actually going to be able to achieve. Although on defense and rebound, he's always looked like, hey, he can play at this level, but the offensive game has just really not been there until today. So I don't know if something clicked or this is just a complete aberration. I'm guessing it's closer to an aberration, although he might be better overall going forward, maybe hit the occasional three. But in general terms, man, the shooting, it is rough out there. And I don't know if you have other thoughts on what you've seen and what's going on.
I mean, I would say the State of the Union, Chase, is like in some respects, right? 1-3 in the last four games, but in some respects, I feel better about the team. Like the ship has been steadied, in my opinion. We often refer to KenPom and Torvik, our favorite, advanced analytics gurus. Torvik gives every team a game score from 0 to 100 for their performance in every game. So you can think about it like grading on a curve or relative to expectations. So if you play like a 99th percentile team in a given game, you get a 99 game score. I say all that to say USC has three out of its best four game scores of the season in the last four games. And again, the crazy thing is they're 1-3 in those games. But be it Purdue, Wisconsin, and then this game, tonight, USC's played really, really well. And obviously, the hits keep coming from an injury standpoint, and kind of Muss is really kind of piecing it together to give us a chance to win these games. And so, look, I think some of the luck, to be undefeated for so long through non-conference play has flipped on us a little bit here. But like, bottom line is their home road split in conference play has been four home games and six road games, and they've won four games. So now the schedule flips on the back half. They're very home dominant the rest of the way. One more big trip back east for Penn State and Ohio State, but they get a full week off after that trip. The other road games are just across town to UCLA and then a hop up to Seattle for a potential revenge game against the Huskies. So I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that like Iowa is better, at least according to the computers and the metrics, than anyone else left on the schedule on the road the rest of the way. So if you're a play from winning at Iowa, like there's no game you can't win. Obviously, we also saw against Northwestern, there's no game you can't lose. So it's gonna, yeah, I think everything is still in front of these guys for the rest of the season. Like there's no reason they can't pull out six or seven wins and put themselves right back into the tournament.
Yeah, and just taking a peek at the schedule. I mean, I'm actually going to be in LA, so I'm going to catch a couple of these games, Rutgers and Indiana coming up. I think those are almost like must-win games. We don't really have another Northwestern type performance to give away. What's going to be key, I think, is going to be the Illinois and Nebraska games at home at Galen. Those are two of the best teams nationally. Illinois has looked better and better and better. It's kind of just. What they were expecting this team to be, the Illinois team with all the Euros, and then it turns out to be this like kind of unheralded freshman Keaton Wagler, who's just like playing like he's a high lottery pick. I mean, just amazing. And one of the, I mean, this is the year of the freshman, obviously. What a performance that he's putting on. We are going to have to steal, I think, one of those games. I think it's doable. We have to play up at Washington. That's going to be an interesting game. Can we actually, Des McLaud is gone for the season now. Yates has been back and forth. He'll probably play, but we'll have to see if we can be competitive in that game. I mean, there's ways for this team to be competitive. I do think I mean, we've now had two different guards, two different mid-major guards break out and have these huge offensive performances, Jordan Marsh and Cam Woods. I think we're going to have to get like more steady play from the two of them. They could actually be a decent combo there. Jordan Marsh is not a good defensive player, so he's got to be a really, really effective. I see he's not a good defensive player. He does some things on defense well, but if he doesn't steal the ball, he's not as effective. Cam Woods can be a very, very good defensive player. He was not good against Wisconsin when he was trying to guard Nick Boyd and didn't realize that Boyd was left-handed apparently for the entire game. But he realized that Bennett Sturtz is left-handed, which is very or is right-handed, which is very important. And he guarded him well as a result of that. We'll have to bring in Jerry Easter a little bit. Jerry, he had this, people are going to be, a lot of people are going to blame him for this loss because he committed this kind of foul out near half court where it looked like Sturtz was trying to call timeout and he reached and the essentially, there's like 4 seconds left on the clock. I mean, it would have been very difficult for Iowa to win. They still could have won the game for sure, even if, if that foul's not called there, but it was not a smart play from Jerry. But Jerry's a freshman and he had, I saw another box where he had 8 rebounds, two assists, didn't miss any shots. He came in, he played well. That's an unfortunate play there for him. A lot of other guys played a lot worse. I mean, look, unfortunately, right after his birthday, Chad comes out and, was turning the ball over like crazy. Did not get a lot from Gabe Dines tonight, unfortunately. Jaden Brunell, got a few minutes here and there, didn't really do much. Cornish looked really, unfortunately, did not look good. So, I'm not going to blame Jerry for the loss because other guys didn't play as well as he did, and they played bad for longer periods of time. But we're going to need Jerry as well. But I think we're going to really need Jordan Marsh back here. Hopefully, turf toe could be a real lingering issue. So hopefully by Saturday he's good to go. If not by next week he's good to go. You just never know. The other component about all this is the Elijah Arenas situation. So before we get to Elijah Arenas, let's just kind of, go back to Nick here. Nick, what putting aside Elijah Arenas, what do you think is like, what are maybe some green shoots here? What could be hopeful to look for the team going forward?
Chase, I think the one thing that's obvious is they don't quit. Like even, with the injuries on the road against Iowa, top 25 KenPom team, you're ahead at halftime and then you spot them effectively 17 points in the first few minutes of the second half. And still like they clawed their way back. They never quit. Not only was Cam, playmaking and making shots, but defensively, like they made adjustments and shut down the 3-point line for the last 8 to 10 minutes of that game. So, I thought it was over. I think everyone thought it was over, and the resiliency was there, and you have to love the effort in that regard. And I guess they've solved the rebounding thing. I guess this was a big problem early in the year is getting defensive rebounds, and they're still not elite at it, but. They're competing, I think, harder on that end, and I think especially defensively, the arrow does seem to be moving in the positive direction. So that's kind of a silver lining there, I think.
Okay, so Jason, before without talking about Elijah Arenas at all, what would you look to? Like, what guy needs to step up? What kind of things need to be achieved from your standpoint, kind of your perspective, that to get us to the point where we can win some of these games and get and sneak into the tournament?
I think Marsh needs to come back healthy, which, obviously is more of a health thing than a performance thing. But I think that, I mean, what you saw from Must tonight was just an absolute commitment to defense, right? Like in terms of all the lineups and personnel, like and with the personnel that we had tonight, that was probably a wise choice. It was driving me crazy when we couldn't score and, I was going on this, 17, 20 point, run in the beginning of the second half. Where's the offense? Put in Brownell, get Chad back in there. Like, let's try to spread them out and make some shots. But like, ultimately, I can't knock him for having a very, very beat up team and losing on the road by one at Iowa and just doing it like fully committed to the offense may look very ugly. And in now I think we've seen multiple games where the offense in the second half of a game is one person, and it can be Chad, it can be Ezra, it can be Jordan Marsh, and now it can apparently be Cam Woods as well, where it's just like that's going to be the guy, and we're just going to go to that person over and over and over again until the other team stops it. It's a unique approach, but it's worked somewhat in terms of like keeping USC afloat in these games. But I just think that this is a long-winded way of saying we need to get more balance on the floor, right? It's like, yeah, we solved the rebounding, but now it's really hard for us to score in the half court. So what lineups can we find where we have some shooting on the floor with some defense, and we don't kind of go all out one way or all out the other way and have a little bit more balance?
Yeah, I completely agree. What we need to say this because I cannot not be said. Cam Woods scored, I think, 17 consecutive points just for USC. I think it topped out at 17. It might have gone up to 19. I think it topped out at 17. But the real great stat to me, and this is not something I don't know if this ever happened in the history of USC basketball. Certainly in a game like, a major conference game, Cam Woods scored 12 consecutive points in the game, meaning he outscored Iowa 12 nothing on a run by himself. Cam Woods, by the way. I was thinking of all the things, if someone were to tell you, hey, by the way, someone in this game is going to USC is going to be down by a lot, and someone's going to, step up and have a big run, and we're going to make a big valiant comeback. We'd say, oh, that doesn't sound surprising. I'm not surprised. And someone say, okay, you pick the player who you think is going to score 17 consecutive points for our team and 12 consecutive points in the game. And of all the choices, I it would have been a while before I got to Cam Woods, for sure.
He would have been last. I mean, let's be honest. He is the last. But I would have thought Cornish could have done it before him. Like, and like, no knock to Ryan, but like that, he would have been last. I mean, he's been on the team for a month now, if that. And he hadn't made a three prior to tonight. How about guys? What did you think when Chad had a decent look at three and he passed it to Cam Woods in the corner? I mean,
Yeah.
even after he had made all those shots in a row, I was like, you can't possibly give it to Cam in the corner. He's made one three the whole season, and it was, 30 seconds ago, and then he swishes another one. I mean, just incredible. And Nick, you said that, we were all thinking the game was over. I mean, it was over. Iowa was up by 15 points with 5.5 minutes left. Like, and
Ridiculous.
to be
Ridiculous.
up by one with 8 seconds left. It's just so tough that they didn't win it, but what heart they showed to get back in that game.
Yeah, by the way, I'm pulling up. Oh,
Cam
go
Woods
ahead.
coming into the game, he was shooting 22% from the field as a guard.
So I don't have the ESPN version of this, but I do have the KenPom version of this. And at the just over the 5 minute mark, just over the 5 minute mark, so like 5 minutes and 12 seconds, Iowa 99.4% to win.
Yeah, I've
Now,
got ESPN in front of me, and it's 99.3 for that same moment.
yeah. Now they did win, so we don't want to. But there was a moment in this game where USC became favored to win in the last 20 seconds or so when Jacob hit that layup under the basket. That it just a, kind of a crazy, remarkable game. It also, we've had these key foul outs very early in game, like the Northwestern game. I think if Chad didn't foul out like when he did, maybe Northwestern still wins because we were really struggling there, but. Maybe not. There's just a lot of this is like a really an evolving team, and they're like trying to piece these all these kind of disparate parts together has been really strange. And I'm not sure when this whole process is going to end. Certainly, like right at the moment, Jordan Marsh kind of steps up and then he gets hurt. And then, I'm sure we're probably going to go to Saturday and Cam Woods is going to be hurt or something, just a weird, weird situation. Okay, let's talk about last basketball topic. Let's talk about Elijah Arenas. The numbers on paper don't look terrible today. He actually was plus six when he was on the court today. He did go 3 for 6 from the field, so he didn't take nearly as many poor shots. He missed his one three, which was an open three. The bad number, 0 rebounds, 0 assists, 0 blocks, 0 steals, and 1 turnover. There are moments when it's like, okay, I think it's like he's kind of getting it, but then like if you put him in a switch, like he cannot, like he doesn't know how to switch off his man to cover three, like on a pick and pop. You know, he leaves his guy open like for three every single time. I mean, that's going to be exploited big time by teams that scout us at all. They see him on the court and he's guarding, you know, he's guarding anybody that could potentially hit a three. I mean, that's going to be absolutely devastating. I'm not sure how we solve for that. And you know, I have to say on offense, I don't want to, I don't want this sounds like I'm criticizing the kid, but look, he played high school at a level that was not a top level. He played at Chatsworth High School. That's not an elite level for Southern California. It's not terrible, but it's not at that upper echelon level, let alone kind of like a prep school level. He enters, you know, he leaves his class early. Now, he's still not a super young guy. He could have, you know, he could have been a senior, but he did take a year. So he didn't have a senior year of high school. And then he's got, you know, he has these two incidents. He has the car incident and then he gets hurt. So he misses the entire summer. I have to say, a guy like Jerry Easter, I remember watching him on those early summer workouts, and Jordan Marsh was kind of just toying with him. Jerry had really, I mean, he improved a ton through that whole process and has become, I mean, Jerry was our, I know that he made that dumb foul at the end. He was our number one guy for plus minus day, plus A. Jerry's kind of like learned how to play college basketball and learned how to play at this level. Elijah never has had that opportunity. He missed the entire summer. He missed the preseason or the camp, summer, fall camp, preseason, and then he missed the first couple months of the season. In addition to that, he's not a sudden athlete. He has a nice kind of crossover game. He has a nice handle, but it's a bit loose. And it's something that I saw in high school that he had this loose handle, very high dribble. He's a tall guy, so he's going to have a tall dribble. And he has not completely refined it yet for I think the college level. And yeah, his suddenness, he doesn't have that like that kind of elite change of direction that you see from a lot of guards. And he's trying to play point guard. And he doesn't quite have the strength that his dad had, you know. So look, it's only his third game, and that's the one thing he's like he's still learning in a process of learning, but it's a struggle for him to be have a positive impact on the court. Now I say that he did go plus six when he was on the court today, but they exploited him in certain situations. He played very nice defense on a switch on Bennett Stewart's late, so I want to give him credit for that. But it's going to be a struggle, and I don't really think, I mean, I think he'll gradually be, I hate to say this, less bad. But I'm not sure that he's going to, quote unquote, have figured out how to play at this level by the time we get to March. You know, there's a lot of aspects of his game that I don't see it. And obviously, I mean, the one thing that would make up for it maybe is if he just hit like crazy shots every time he shot it because he's so much taller than who's ever guarding him. But he shot decent in the mid-range, decent, not good, decent, okay. He hasn't hit a three yet. That's a big wind up. Nick, I'll just throw it to you. Is Elijah Arenas going to be a net positive for this team in meaningful minutes at some point this season? If so, when? Or do you think this is not going to happen?
Chase, I think he has to shoot, right? Because the defense isn't going to happen. I think he has the capability to do it. Like you looked at when he got switched on to Bennett Sturts on the second to last defensive possession of the game, he actually held up okay because he, you know, got in a stance and really guarded and knew that was a, you know, huge possession in the game. But, you know, you had other instances like you mentioned where he got lost on pick and pop. Didn't box out his man, and you know a lot of rebounding is effort, and he's a tall guy, and you know getting zero rebounds at that size is a problem, and you know he kind of has to want to do it. So I don't think that you know a light's suddenly going to come on in that regard on the defensive ends. Now, I do think he can be a net positive on offense if he can consistently make open threes, and he hasn't done it yet. But you know, the team doesn't have the margin for error for him to be taking like you know fadeaway mid-range low percentage jump shots to try to get into a rhythm because It's a low percentage shot, and you throw away a possession. And in a game like this, every possession is going to matter. So I do think he's very young. He's talented. He needs an off season. But his style of play is just not conducive to winning. And it might not be next year, but I'd be surprised if he was a super net positive the rest of the year.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you, Jason, the same question, but I'm also going to ask you to think, wonder about, would it make sense to kind of, maybe just put Elijah in the corner, on offense, let him, try to, when there's when his man is slagging off him, take a like a wide open three, and then, maybe try to do some offensive rebounding, stuff like that, rather than worrying about playing around the perimeter, and ball handling. I know he's supposed to be a point guard. I know that's part of the deal with him, but I, does it make sense to try to get him into some sort of shooting rhythm before putting all this like pressure on him to be like a major ball handler and shot creator?
I mean, look, if you're gonna play Cam Woods 40 minutes, then like he doesn't have to be a primary ball handler. So like I think he can kind of, be playing out on the wing and not have like all of those ball handling responsibilities. But ultimately, I do think if this team is to hit its ceiling, and obviously its ceiling is, limited compared to what it would have been, frankly, with Rodney and Omarion and the whole crew. Like if the team is gonna hit what it's capable of, it's gonna need more from Elijah. And so look, Mus has started him every game that he's played. He's given him minutes. He's kind of grown through it. I haven't been, thrilled with what I've seen, but I like today was better. Today was definitely better. I think the shot selection was better. I think one thing that I've observed, especially with like we talked about it with Marsh in prior games. When he was at, his past school, right? Like if you go look at his shooting numbers, it is not efficient at all. Like it is very, very bad. I mean, the shot diet was, he was the guy on a low major team and they put the ball in his hands and he was gonna let it fly no matter what. And so the percentages suffered. But now, right, you bring him into a high major program and you have him around other talented guys, and Mus really kind of has harped on, if you're gonna shoot, you're gonna take great shots. And he has done that this year and has, boosted his 3-point percentage. I believe he's still about 41% for the year. So that's what kind of what you wonder about with Elijah. Like, can you get through to him with, hey, you're part of this team now. You're not a Chatsworth anymore. We don't need you to score 50. We need you to play within the flow of the offense and take a good shot if it's there, but, turn it down unless it's a good or great shot. And so I was a little encouraged tonight that I didn't see that many just like, it's not like the Chad level, the shot clock's running out kind of hero ball turnaround shots that, Chad takes and sometimes makes. But yeah, I felt like the first game with Elijah, right, where he took 15 shots. I mean, his usage is like even after tonight, still like a little bit out of control. Like just needs to be reined in and encouraged to, play within the offense and not just take the first decent shot he can take.
Before we turn to football, there's one more thought I just thought we maybe could explore a little bit. Mus is obviously very good at creating situations where players can go off and kind of, almost as like shot creators, just go off and score tons of points. We've seen that many times from Chad this season. Last year, we saw it a lot with both with Desmond Claude and with Wesley Yates. We saw Ezra go off a little bit, and obviously Jordan Marsh earlier, just a couple games ago, and then Cam Woods does again today. But this is nothing new. It's one of the reasons Gilbert Arenas wanted Elijah to come to USC and play there because he thought, hey, look, this, he's the kind of guy that he'll let you be that shot creator. I mean, I guess the question I have right now is, I mean, this is such a biased question because things change so quickly and the kid has been off for so long and missed so much time. But is Elijah Arenas a draftable player at this moment? I did see a list that came out from On3 about 2 days ago that still had him going in the first round. Most of these lists have not, but then he came back from injury and maybe they're going to include him again. But I'm starting to wonder. I remember DeMar DeRozan having kind of a lot of there were being a lot of big question marks around his play until we got to the Pac-12, or the, I guess back then, Pac-10 tournament. And then he started to really elevate his play, but he always impacted the game positively from the standpoint of rebounding and just being physical, playing tough physical defense. I'm not sure that Elijah is quite as good as we might have thought he was going to be. And that's my question, Nick. Is he as good as we thought he was going to be?
I mean, it's hard to say, Chase, with the injuries, but he's nowhere near an impact player on the college level. And if you put him in an NBA game right now, he'd be a total net negative on both sides of the ball. So I'm not saying there's not potential there. I think his shot mechanics are great. Like, he's got the bloodlines, but he's a kid who just reclassed, right? You have the reclassification combined with the injuries. Like, he's super young. I hope for his sake he pumps the brakes a little bit and just enjoys college and just tries to get better. I think there's so much development ahead for him to be a positive player on the NBA level. So I hope for him, like, he does another year of college. Like, I think that would make a ton of sense for him.
Well, Jason, you can weigh in on this one too. What do you think?
I mean, look, like if you want to do go back all the way to DeMar, like DeMar couldn't shoot at USC at all, right? So like
Right.
that they kind of have that in common from distance. The difference was like DeMar was still able to get to the rim and get his shot and was shooting efficiently from two and getting fouled. So like I think that's in Elijah. Like I did. I mean, you go back to the Northwestern game, like right off the bat, he's like slicing down the lane, spinning layup, like you can't teach some of the things that he does. And like if Cam Woods can go for 30 something points, like certainly like Elijah can blow up. Like I would not put that past him at all. That at some point in these 10 games, we get a game like that from where it's like Elijah's the one that's just taking over. I mean, he has the talent, but yeah, just such a long layoff and the health stuff. Like it's a lot to expect for him to do that. So I think, we'll see. Yeah, right now I'm not sure what NBA teams would be seeing that they would be, ready to draft him other than kind of taking a chance on the bloodlines. But yeah, on the court it's not quite there yet.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I don't want to be down on the kid. I think he can still bounce back and just, really show out. But, I'm kind of with you guys on that. Okay. Let's talk. There's so much football stuff. I can't resist. I know we're a basketball podcast, but this is just too much. All right, Jason, I got to go with you first because you did one. I mean, I've already mentioned it. You did one of the great posts of all time and this really in-depth analysis on who should we should hire as the defensive coordinator. I think you made really compelling arguments. Clearly, Lincoln Riley either didn't read your post or was not persuaded by it, or he was already biased against it because he already thought he knew who was going to be the who he wanted to go with. What do you make of this whole situation? I mean, I guess the thing is, when you're doing your analysis, you're looking at different active defensive coordinators. And Gary Patterson hasn't been like a, titular defensive coordinator, even though he was the defensive coordinator for TCU, but he hasn't been the titular defensive coordinator since, like, whatever, 2001 or the year 2000. So he's not going to be on your data analysis. Do you have, I'm sure you've done a little bit of looking into the numbers here, but I don't need a full-blown analysis if you don't have one ready. But what are your thoughts here on this? I mean, this is just so completely a different direction than kind of like the analysis that you were doing.
Yeah, very, very interesting hire. people, I've been so busy like with work and everything, and people have been bumping that post that I did, and somebody actually like entered my original post into ChatGPT and basically responded as though they were me with what they thought my analysis of Gary Patterson would be. So the official response is actually not that different from what ChatGPT said I would think, which is he does check a lot of the same boxes that I was talking about when I was looking at my search, and that was specifically around playing a certain style of defense that is complementary to an elite offense. And my theory of the case has always been that you need to play a more aggressive kind of sellout style of defense to go with the offense, because it gives you just kind of more, it's higher variance, but it's also it also reduces variance a little bit, in that the more innings there are in a game, so to speak, back and forth, the great offense has more of a chance to shine. And so, yeah, you're going to give up, you play super aggressively, you might give up a score, but then the offense gets the ball again, and we kind of run it back. Where I think USC under Dan Ten Lin this season kind of did the opposite, right? They were really kind of grinding out games, trying to just slow things down. There weren't as many possessions in USC games this year, even though the offense statistically, like on a per drive basis, was very elite, but the scores of the games were lower. And I actually think you generally want to push it to be, hey, the game may end up with higher scores both ways, but if you believe your offense is the best unit on the field, that's how you create margin. And so I think that Patterson specifically gives you that. He gives you a great level of aggressiveness. His percentage of drives that are completely blown up with, teams not gaining any yards and getting a turnover, getting a quick three and out, is very, very high relative to the other folks that USC was, either employing or considering. So that I am very bullish on. It is higher risk, high reward. I did a quick look today just at like comparing Lynn's defense with Patterson's defense. The guy that does FEI, the advanced metric for offenses and defenses and teams overall, gives, similar to like what I was saying earlier with Torvik, he gives like a game score for every defensive performance. And so what you see when you compare Danton Lynn with Gary Patterson, in his career at TCU, is that Patterson has across the board a much higher percentage of outstanding performances, but he also has like some clunkers along the way. And I think that just has to do with kind of the aggressive style, where Lynn was kind of, you knew what you were going to get, in that you were never going to get a kind of bottom of the barrel, like the bottom falls out kind of performance. He was very good at avoiding disastrous performances. But whether you were going to get kind of like a fair to middling performance versus a great performance was always up in the air. So with Patterson, you're going to get more great performances with the risk of an occasional, really bad outlier game. So
Continue
those are
on.
the
Sorry,
initial
I
thoughts, but we can keep going.
yeah, keep going. Keep continue on.
No. So I mean, look, the other thing I wanted to really look at was like age and kind of like age related decline, so to speak, and if that was a thing. Obviously with athletes it's a thing, but is it a thing with coaches? And so I was just looking at, I limited this to Big Ten and SEC coaches in the last 10 years, and just coaches that have coached seasons over age 60, and like, is there a point where like it kind of falls off a cliff? And really I was surprised to see that it really does not. At coaches 60 in their age 61 season, right? Five had a better season than they had at age 60. Three had a worse. So I'm just looking at, as you get older, what's the percentage chance that it's getting better versus getting worse? And the long and short of it is, like, there's pretty much, say for 1 year, like there's a at least a, as good of a chance that you're going to improve as you're going to get worse. By the end of it, the entire analysis is just Kirk Ferentz and Nick Saban are the two coaches, and pretty much every year one of them got better and one of them got worse, all the way to age 70. So the biggest predictor of like how good you were was just like how good you were when you first started. Like Saban's teams were Saban's teams all the way through. Iowa's teams have been Iowa's teams all the way through. You're not getting like big swings of performance. So I kind of think like if it works, it's going to work right away and it should be good. But if it's bad right away, then I would be worried that that's just what it's going to be.
There is a, I remember there was a big, there was analysis about this going way back to the turn of the century on Bobby Bowden, because he had just come off, I think, at 11 and either his undefeated season in 1999 or maybe the following season. And they were saying how much longer can he did that do this? And they looked at a couple other, because this is back in the era where, coaches coached longer. and they try to do an analysis like what ha you know what is the age when the drop off really starts. Now, after that 2000 season, it looks like there was a decline for Bobby Bowden, because even though he had had a top five team every season since from 87 through 2000, he never had another one during his time at Florida State, and he remained the head coach for another 9 seasons. Although they were not bad, except for a couple seasons around 2006. But at the after that 2000 season, he was 71 years old. And you did see from, having hit 71, the next few years, 2001, 2, 3, and 4, more middling, still really want to, he's still taking his team to elite bowl games, Gator, Sugar, Orange, and even Orange in 2005, although that's probably a lot of it's on reputation, and just the popularity of the team. And then you see the tail off really, starting in 2006. That's at a time when he is now 77 years old. So, and also he's not, I don't know how healthy Gary Patterson is, but there was definitely an aspect to Bobby Bowden that he'd kind of like stepped away. I mean, I remember, I don't know if you guys remember this, you might be too young, but Jason, you might remember this. He would be doing, he would have the headset on talking to the booth during the games. Booth being the TV commentators during the plays. So he had kind of detached himself a little bit from the program. Obviously not the same kind of thing you see from Gary Patterson. I kind of think if the coach is not a big drinker, has a relatively healthy lifestyle, that you're going to continue to perform well until like age 70, age 71, age 72. I don't expect Kurt Cignetti to have this rapid decline, starting next year or anything like that. I think he'll probably be good for another 8 years. You can take a look at a guy like Patino or Kelvin Sampson. I think those guys are, Sampson doesn't look like the healthiest guy in the world, but those guys are guys that are in their 70s and are really, certainly in the case of Sampson, like top of his game. So I think you
He's
can absolutely do this. It takes a lot of energy, but he's just had a few years off, so we'll see how it goes. Nick, we've been talking. What are your thoughts on this stuff in general? I one stat out I just want to bring up to bolster what Jason was talking about. For Pat, this is kind of a crazy stat. Every year from 20 his Bulldogs team from 2013 to 2020, before that last season where things fell apart. So 2013 to 2020. So he's at this point he's in the Big Ten. So this is every year he's in the Big Ten or Big 12. Every year he's in the Big 12, he has at least 80 tackles for loss. His defense says every season. And to give you a comp for like our team this year, we had 73 tackles for losses, and some of those came pretty early in the season. And last year, we had 53 tackles for losses. So, tackles for losses is one barometer of how aggressive a team is. I mean, clearly his teams are disruptive, aggressive, what have you. Okay, that's all being said. Nick, what are your thoughts in general on Gary Patterson, this whole situation?
Yeah, so many thoughts, Chase. First off, just the entire process, how long it took. I'm really surprised. Don't know what was behind that, or if there was ever a reason given for why they waited so long to name Gary Patterson. It's not like he's employed, or was employed in another university. And obviously he's a legend, Hall of Fame coach, had success not only in the Mountain West, but in the Big 12. And then even kind of on his way out, he gave Sonny Dykes that roster, and that team, that TCU team, made the championship under Dykes before getting blown out by Georgia. So I think he's a phenomenal coach, and his defenses have been very fundamentally sound and aggressive, which I think is what you want if you're USC. I think kind of my challenge is like, will he have full autonomy of the defense? Because I agree with everything you guys have said about the aggressive mindset and the approach, but Alex Grinch was also kind of an aggressive DC, right? Like the idea under Grinch was they wanted to win the turnover margin and force turnovers, and they did a lot of really weird stuff with their, stunting of the defensive linemen who were undersized. So, that concerns me, and I think there are still very legitimate questions whether, if you replace the DC, will the defense actually improve, or is it more just a problem with Lincoln Riley's program, where he's incapable of having a team play good defense? So I guess time will tell on that. But yeah, I mean, obviously, like, Gary's a very professional hire, and I don't have concerns about the age thing, and hopefully he has full autonomy over the defense.
Yeah, so I would say that I think that's got to be a big hope is that, I mean, we've heard this, it's almost a cliche at this point that you have the head coach of the defense. I mean, is how to what extent is that going to be the case? I mean, are they literally going to have are the teams offense and defense going to do two different sets of warm-ups and calisthenics before the practices start? Are they going to be on separate weight programs? The Gary Patterson one and the Lincoln Riley. I don't think it's going to go to that level of extreme. They're going to have to get on the same page a little bit about some of these things. But, I remember, I mean, I've watched a ton of these old videos on YouTube about Gary Patterson's philosophy and things he stresses. And the big thing was for him was these certain exercises that had to do with like loosening the hips. I mean, is that going to be incorporated into the, just the warm-up routine? Obviously, it's probably at the end of the day, how much it matters, I don't know. But it would be indicative of you almost have two completely separate teams going out there. And as crazy as that may sound, it's not unprecedented. And in the NFL, it actually happens quite a bit more often than people realize. And a couple of like famous examples is the Tampa Bay situation with Jon Gruden, where Monty Kiffin was the defensive coordinator. And I think the general feeling was that it was like these were two completely separate teams. And at that point in time, the defense had no respect for the offense, and the offense had to earn their respect. And they ended up winning a Super Bowl. The most famous illustration of this is probably the Chicago Bears, the 85 Bears, where this was a Buddy Ryan defense from before Ditka arrived. I mean, now everyone, because of the whole Saturday Night Live thing and everyone, Mike Ditka is like a complete legend, but Ditka came to a team that where he had been, first of all, he'd been the special teams coordinator for Dallas. He was not even an offensive defensive coordinator. He was a special teams coordinator at Dallas. He had been a Hall of Fame level tight end for the Bears, and he got a huge fight with George Halas, the owner, and they traded him. They traded him away. And so he had a huge fight with Halas and basically asked Halas 20 years later, can I be the head coach of the team? At the time, he comes in and he's comes into a situation where the Bears already have that defense. It's already there, and they just needed the offense to go with it. And those were two completely kind of segregated units where, I mean, Buddy Ryan, really, that famous 85 Bear defense had was not a Mike Ditka defense. That was a Buddy Ryan defense. Now the question is, are we going to see that level of kind of like a complete separation? I don't know. I do think that's probably what it's going to take, though, because I don't think, I mean, I've already illustrated this more and I've posted it online, but I don't know if I said it here, but like if you go through all the aspects of what a head coach of college football has to do, it's not just being the coordinator of the defense. When you're the head coach that's overseeing the defensive coordinator, you're running the practices, you're organizing the practices, your defensive coordinator to some extent has to live within that kind of that framework that you're creating. And it hasn't ever worked for Lincoln Riley. And we've seen in this past couple seasons, he's struggling with all other aspects of head coaching other than being the head coach for the offense. So he's struggling with, the game management aspect of being a head coach outside of actually calling plays. He's struggling and offensive personnel packages. He's struggling with, when to call timeouts, and manage your timeouts. Obviously, supervising the special teams was a complete joke. I mean, he had a, and this, I'm going to go on a bit of a rant here, but I thought a lot of people don't, especially if you didn't play football, you might not realize this. Historically, the special teams coach is coaching the teams, not the kicking specialists. Our special teams coach was a essentially an instructor for the kicking specialist. He's, and that's why we've had great kickers and punters. But the teams, the return guys, the coverage guys, those are supposed to be, the guys coaching them are is supposed to be a football coach. And we really had a kicking specialist overseeing this, and that's why our coverage and return teams were, I mean, really amongst the worst in the country. I mean, historically bad by USC standards this season. They haven't been good in other seasons. All, even as we had this like really strong actual punter or good kicker, but we don't have the actual teams around them. So, Lincoln Riley's been bad as a head coach at supervising that. So I think he has needed somebody to kind of come in and say, look, you can't be the head coach of the defense. I mean, like, not just defensive coordinator. Like, I do really think D'Anton Lynn, I mean, he's the game day defensive coordinator, but I mean, I don't think that he was actually taking that leadership role in totality over the defense. And I'm hopeful maybe Gary Patterson can do that. I think that's what it's going to take. Because I don't think Lincoln Riley can do it otherwise. It's just what I've seen so far. So I'll let you guys comment on that as we bring up one more topic to go here on the Gary Patterson thing. Where Doug Belk is out. There's a question of what Eric Henderson is going to return. Mike Eckler is coming in to coach the special teams and the linebackers. Paul Gonzalez was brought in from Baylor, who was a long time with Patterson. And then we have the whole situation with just the way our personnel looks on defense. So, I'll throw it over to you, Jason, with these questions, and you can also comment on what I was just talking about on like, Lincoln Riley kind of supervising the entire team. First off, do you think that too much or not enough is being made about, these assistant coaches who the players seem to love so much and are going to be resentful if these guys leave, like Doug Belk? And two, do you think we're going to see any surprises with the way Gary Patterson runs his 4-2-5 defense? Are we going to see any personnel surprises? And I guess we could talk a little bit too about how his 4-2-5 differs from other people. So I'll throw all those different topics, and you can take whatever you want, Jason.
Look, I think Chase, like the bottom line with the whole Riley discourse right now is like this is his last chance hire, in my opinion, right? So like he's staking everything on this. So I'm gonna take him at his word, and like I hope that he does not sink and that he very much swims and that like this just works out really well. I will say, like Patterson in his press conference today, like did allude to Coach Henny and some of the other coaches that have been around. So it sounds, at least for the moment, like obviously you want Eric to be happy as well, but it sounds like for the moment he's going to incorporate the staff members that are here, and he's going to bring in Gonzalez, as you spoke about, and Eckler's in the fold as well. And so yes, it will be very interesting to see how much is kind of delegated to him. I think in the press conference today, he made it basically sound like he was thrilled to just be like back coaching defense, and not worrying about NIL and transfer portal and every other aspect of it. So in that respect, I think it can work really well. One statistic that I just wanted to pull, and it's a little more anecdotal than hard stats, but I just looked back at the last few guys that have jumped from the head coaching ranks in college down to coordinator. And actually, nobody that I was able to find has done it on the defensive side of the ball, but there are a bunch of guys who have done it on the offensive side of the ball, and they've actually had really good success for the most part. Chip Kelly going to Ohio State, the offense the year before from FEI was number 14, was number one. They win the championship. Gus Malzahn, this year, Florida State, their offense was number 118. The prior season, they were number 19 this season with him making that jump. Bobby Petrino going to Texas A&M that first season, their offense was 75th. Then they were 23rd with him. Dana Holgorsen kind of held things level at Nebraska this season relative to where they were, so didn't really gain or lose much. Bill O'Brien went to Alabama. They went down from number one to number two, so I think you still take that, right? And then Kevin Sumlin goes to Maryland, and minor improvement in 2023. So Four out of the six went up. The two that went down very incrementally from where they were. So I think, I would have a hard time thinking that the defense is going to be worse than it was this year. The
You know,
question is, can it kind of reach those elite heights?
a couple of guys, there is like Al Golden, right? He didn't do it in like back to back years, but he had been a college head coach and then come back
At Temple,
all,
yeah.
yeah, and eventually
Miami.
came back and he had quite a bit of success. Now he's younger. He's about 7 years or 8 years younger than Gary Patterson, but that's
Right.
interesting.
Yeah, and the last thing I would say, Chase, is like just if you look at what he's done relative to his roster talent, there are 15 years of FEI data since he obviously predates even FEI as a metric, but his roster talent outperformance has been consistently excellent. 13 out of those 15 seasons in the database, he outperformed his roster talent. So if you think about what the composite is going to be for USC next year, I think they were around 16, 17 this year, bringing in a number one recruiting class and a bunch of, not that many transfers, but the transfers they did bring in are highly rated. I would imagine that USC's roster talent is going to be somewhere around maybe, I don't know, 10 this year. So if you're saying there's like a 13 in 15 chance that he's going to outperform 10, right? That's compelling.
Okay, Nick, same question, series of questions to you. Any thoughts on any of this stuff?
Let me throw a question to you, Chase, just really quick. Do you know why this took so long?
Oh,
I've
I was
just
going to address that. During his press conference today, who knows the accuracy of this? He flat out came out and said, I wanted to be in the college, in the Hall of Fame, not the college football, but the Hall of Fame. So it's apparently he had to sit out 3 years and then wait for the nomination process to go forward. So after he was officially nominated, I think that happened around, I want to say January 12th, something like that. It took another 2 weeks. Now, the interesting reporting on this is from SCMLT. I think that's his name on the Peristyle. He was the one who identified before nobody else had mentioned this name at all. I mean, just and people had actually, in response to him, were just out of hand rejecting it. He was the first one to mention that Gary Patterson was, pursuing the USC job. We know from Gary Patterson's colleague at the Amazon Prime Big 12 show, Drake Toll, that in fact at that very time period, Patterson was already locked into USC. So not only was this guy correct, but like he was correct to the point that like it was later confirmed from this guy Toll that Patterson was locked into SC at that point. The same guy then said Oregon made a late run at him, which is an interesting story. Like we don't, I mean, who knows all the details of this, but that is on its own is kind of interesting because Oregon lost both coordinators, right? So they lost Will Stein and they lost Tosh Lapoy, who's now the head coach of Cal. And they just essentially promoted from within. And so they're, now their defensive coordinator is a guy that had been on their staff. I mean, he's a seasoned football coach, but not somebody that has, it's Chris Hampton, not somebody that has like a long history of being a great defensive coordinator. So if the story is correct, and I 100% believe it's true because this guy had the scoop on Patterson, Oregon came in and tried to hire Patterson. For what job is not entirely clear. It could not be the defensive coordinator job because like Chris Hampton had that, but it might have been a position that is more than the job he took at Texas with Sark, where he was the special assistant to the head coach. It might have been a assistant head coach and maybe coach of the safeties, and he would have been the real defensive coordinator. We don't know. We can't know that. It was it was enough of an offer that it caused some sort of delay. Now there's another week that took place after that, and who knows what buttoning up all those last elements of getting him hired. I don't know, but I do think that part of the delay was him wanting to get that Hall of Fame thing locked in, and then this whole Oregon thing coming up. Now, all that being said, it would have been nice to have him while we were looking, making choices from the transfer portal, because I do not get the sense that he was heavily influencing who we decided to go after. I mean, we didn't go after one safety, and that's kind of his speciality. But by the same token, I do think my guess is that Lincoln Riley was nervous that if Doug Belk left the staff, or certainly Eric Harrison left the staff prior to the close of the portal, we might see some other departures. That's just my guess on that. I don't have proof of that. So that's my best shot at why it took so long.
Yeah, super interesting. And just, thinking about Gary's scheme and the personnel, like we've talked at length on this podcast and on the peristyle, it's been well documented. We have holes at linebacker, right? Like we're not confident in the personnel at linebacker, and it's almost devalued in the scheme, right? With the 4-2-5, and the issue is maybe it won't be as much at linebacker, and maybe it's more at safety. So it's kind of interesting just thinking through that aspect. But I also kind of wonder if like it's better to have kind of an older guy on defense, coaching with Lincoln Riley. Like, maybe Gary is a guy that Lincoln respects more, having coached against him in the Big 12 and seen it up close in person. And like with D'Anton Lynn, like young, bright minds, but he'd only been UCLA's DC for 1 year prior to coming to USC. So you kind of wonder if like there was even some hesitancy on Lincoln's mind, right, in terms of delegating the entire defense over to him, and whether Lincoln meddled at all in that. It kind of makes you wonder. But my other question, maybe for both you guys, schedule looks brutal for next year. I guess, what does a successful season look like? Is it just making the playoff? And is the buyout low enough to the point where if we have an 8-4 season, like, do you guys see that actually being the end for Lincoln?
Jason, I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, I think a lot of the press has kind of gotten behind the, put up or shut up, playoffs or bust, and I'm just not sure with the schedule. I'm really not sure, and I think. I don't know. Reading my own personal tea leaves, like I don't have any sources in the program, but it feels like the schedule this year is really a bear. And then I think it lightens up a little bit in 27, which is also, your heralded freshman class. If you're able to retain the good ones, now you're a year older. You've now a year into the system with Patterson, and it feels like they need to be setting up for, I know we keep saying this, like kicking the can down the road for when is it really going to happen. But like, if I were thinking like as a betting man, like when would the best chance be for like USC to make a serious run at a championship? It probably isn't this year given the schedule. It's probably next year. And so the question is like, what level of performance do you need to get out of this roster this season to say, hey, like one last ride next year? Or is it just a question of, hey, the buyout is still too much to even n entertain, making a change? But it feels like you don't necessarily want to blow it up this year. I don't know. That's my opinion. I could see a scenario where, USC goes 9-3 again next year and they don't make the playoffs, but man, they had one great win and they lost one game they weren't supposed to, whatever, but like 9-3 against that schedule, still progress against 9-3 against a lighter schedule this year. And so, run it back one more time. I know USC fans don't like to hear that, kind of stuck in purgatory repeat mode, but like I could see that happening.
Yeah, and I think unfortunately for some of our expectations, I think Lincoln Riley's actually owed a little bit more money than we realize. Like, my source on that, who's an impeccable source, I can't really get into details, but I'm just going to say that amount. Like, he it's not what people think the buyout is, it's more than that. So, now it's just money, whatever. But I do kind of think we're locked into this. Could there be a scenario though where if the defense does show some signs of improvement, that we're, it's kind of like, Gary Patterson's more running the show and Lincoln Riley's just running the offense. I have no idea. It's hard to say. And I can imagine if we have some tough losses, we'll be very upset and we'll want someone to blame. And, a lot of times it looks like it's, this, the accountability should fall on Lincoln Riley. So, but that being said, maybe we should just talk about the schedule for a second. So the interest, so we have these kind of, you break the season, the schedule into almost like three big segments here. We're going to start with the first four games. We have to go 4-0 for sure, which is we start off with a week zero game against an opponent to be determined. Then we have Fresno State at home. That could, Fresno State's going to be terrible, so that they can give us a somewhat competitive game, but we got to win. Then we have Louisiana at home. Then we go out all the way across the country to play at Rutgers. That, that can go any way. I've been to games at Rutgers where Washington struggled a bit. Oregon absolutely blew their doors off this past season. But, that shouldn't necessarily be a super easy game for us, especially we're not great on the road. However, given what we have coming back, we would hope that that's a game that we win. The very next week, we come back and then we have essentially the start of the next kind of, big part of the schedule, and that is 3 weeks in a row where we play at home against Oregon, at home against Washington, then we travel to State College to play Penn State, which is basically Iowa State, in a new time zone, with more a lot more fans and new uniforms. So those are going to be incredibly difficult games. Oregon spent a ton of money to basically try to bring back their most of their entire team. A couple guys are gone, but they have the offensive line is going to have to be rebuilt a little bit. But they have a lot of the same guys are back there. Their depth kind of transferred out. A lot of it transferred out. And they have a whole new recruiting class coming in. So, they're kind of focused on their top guys, the guys that are going to get on the field. I think that's where they want to spend the money, and they did. Washington could be a very tough team, but hopefully playing in Los Angeles. It's a game we're going to have to win. I think Lincoln Riley needs to win that game no matter what. And then we go, going out and playing this new kind of Penn State team. This is going to be a tricky one for Riley because he struck Mike Riley struggled against Iowa State. That was like one of the teams that Matt Campbell really kind of had his number quite a bit, and now putting them in Penn State uniforms. I really think this is a mid-tier Big 12 quality team talent-wise, but it's a what going to be a well-coached team with a lot of veteran players. It's going to be a little bit like the Illinois situation we had this season with even better crowd atmosphere, and so we're going to just have to play better and step up to win that game, and I think that's kind of like a crucial win as well. Then the next, we have a bye week, and we have the next like kind of key block of the schedule, which is Camp Randall Stadium, in late October. Depending on the time of the day that game kicks off, hopefully it'll be a somewhat earlier kickoff because the later you get, it's going to be colder and the crowds will get into it more. Then we come back home Halloween day or Halloween night, Ohio State at the Coliseum, bye week, mid-November, out to Bloomington. Never in the history of football until the last couple of years is that a daunting game, but now it looks like one of the most difficult games to play in college football, especially with in weather. Come back home, play Maryland, and then finish off with UCLA. I will just say this about the schedule. I think the toughest game is going to be in Indiana. I don't think there's going to be a lot of dispute about this. I think the second toughest game will actually be Oregon at home, not Ohio State. That's my guess. I think Oregon is not changing time zones. They're used to playing at the Coliseum. I think they're going to think that this is a very critical game for them. That is going to be an absolute brutal game, for both teams. And, the Ohio State game a little bit later in the season. Look, Ohio State can win that. They won up in Seattle late in the season last year, kind of convincingly. But I do think that game will not. it's going to be a little bit more daunting for them. They're changing time zones. I'm guessing it's going to be a late kickoff, probably, 8 o'clock, 8:30, East Coast time. And it's going to be a tough environment for them. So I think the two toughest games on the schedule, in my opinion, are at Indiana and versus Oregon. If you can win one of those two games and then, only falter maybe one other game through this regular season, I think you do make the college football playoff. If you lose both of those games, you still have the opportunity to beat Ohio State at home. But I think you'd have to obviously do that to even have an argument to make the college football playoff. Nick, any thoughts there?
Wow, a lot there, Chase. I agree. The Indiana game is going to be extremely tough. Yeah, I mean they're the champs. They're playing the last two champs, one at home, one on the road. And Oregon NIL's a bunch of their draft eligible juniors back, so that's going to be extremely difficult. But yeah, I mean I guess like if we can't beat Oregon at home, like we couldn't beat them on the road last year, like. I don't know. Lincoln Riley, this is what, year five coming up? Is
Yeah.
that right? If you can't beat Oregon at home in year five, what does the future look like? Right? I mean, I don't know.
Yep, I agree. Jason, any thoughts?
No, I'm aligned. I think if you kind of group it into those key stretches, like the first one starting with the Oregon game and through Penn State, that kind of three game cluster with Washington, and then again, the stretch with Wisconsin, Ohio State, and Indiana, right? Like, it's tough, but like you got to find a way to get through. I don't think if you lose more than one game, coming out of that first half, it's going to be a very difficult uphill battle to then, have to play Ohio State and Indiana coming down the stretch, and knowing that you must win one of those games is a tough hill to climb.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I know it's getting late. I'm going to throw one last question out there. We got new rivals, which now is kind of merged with On3 rankings this week. And Luke Waifel moved all the way up to number one overall player. We had Jimmy and Winfield moved up, I think, to number 11 overall. Nick, give me a few guys you think true freshmen who actually will play big minutes. But don't include, you can include anyone you want, but don't include guys who you don't think are going to play big minutes.
Okay, so I think Waifel is deserving of number one. I think it's absurd how low he is in other rankings. So cool to see that Rivals gave him that honor. I think he will play. I think Winfield's probably will play. I know Pepe is pretty highly regarded. I'm not sure he plays, just given what we have coming back on the offensive line. Maybe he's like the sixth lineman and they kind of rotate him in. I think Elbert Hill will play. His tape is really good, a little bit undersized, but he has the track times to back it up too. Talanoa Ely, I think, will probably play too, just because we're not that deep at linebacker. So he probably plays at least on special teams, but I think he'll get into that linebacker rotation. And then, you probably pick one of Caden Dixon-Wyatt and Booby Feaster at receiver. And I kind of thought it would be Feaster, but Dixon Wyatt did look pretty good in the Army Bowl, and I think is a little bit more polished than Feaster. And Feaster is super young and reclassified, and has, I think, better pro potential. But I'm kind of leaning, I guess, towards Dixon Wyatt cracking the rotation year one.
Same question for you, Jason.
You guys are more the experts in the player
Yeah,
personnel
that's a
here,
good
but
point.
I was no, I it's great to see the guys getting a bump that deserve it from going out to these all-star games and actually performing. I'll be interested to see like 247 when they come out with their final, if it's we see similar bumps, but it does, big picture for me, I think it's a little bit of validation of Chad Bowden like getting out in front of some of these guys, where we knew with like Waifel was going back and forth with Ohio State at the end, is he gonna stay, is he gonna go, and it sounds like we really kind of came in with the Godfather offer to keep him from flipping over there, and then to see that then be validated when he goes to an All-American game and dominates and ends up being the top player in the country is like, okay, like That makes me feel good about the people that we have, evaluating talent and making those financial decisions for who to prioritize.
Yeah, and so I'm going to go with exactly what by the way, I completely agree with those sentiments. I'm going to go the exact same list that Nick had. I'll throw out there Trent Mosley because I think he will get some run. And then the other one was, would you probably agree with is Mark Bowman, a tight end, just because I don't think we have
Yes.
it. We don't have any tight ends.
Right.
He's kind of been like the forgotten man because he didn't play in that All-Star game. He played in the Pauley All-Star game, which got like no coverage this year for some reason. I don't fully understand that, but it is what it is. Okay. Before we get out of here, any last thoughts? I'll go to you first, Nick, and then we'll get out and get going.
Just last thought quickly on the basketball team. I think the fun part of being in the Big Ten is you have so many opportunities. So, you drop the game to Northwestern and then you come back and beat Wisconsin on the road. So I think it's just, regardless of how the team's doing, it's a fun league to play in with a lot of really highly competitive, fun games.
Jason, you got anything?
I mean, I would just say, look, like, coming back home, I know that's been a point of emphasis coming off of long road trips. The worry about that first game back has been something that Mus has stressed, and this first game back is absolutely critical because you're not going to see a more beatable opponent this season than Rutgers. That would be a very, very tough loss to take. So I think kind of like it's a quick turn here. They got 2 days off, but they got to get right back at it, and that's pretty much a must-win game on Saturday. So I don't see why they wouldn't be able to take care of business, but looking forward to them hopefully being able to turn the page on this tough trip here and maybe get a little run going here down the stretch. Should be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Jordan Marsh and Cam Woods combining for 50 points against Rutgers on Saturday. That's tongue in cheek, everyone. Okay, thanks everyone for joining us. Nick, Jason, I kept you guys up late. Thank you so much. And until next time, everybody, fight on.
Right on.
Right on.